Welcome to A Life in Biography. Last week's topic was the ethics of biography. I'm going to continue that. Eventually, I'm going to have other guests on my podcast again, but I needed sort of a breather from podcasts. And then I got this book, which I mentioned last week, from Samuel R. Delaney, otherwise known to his friends as Chip Delaney. I consider myself a friend of his, although we've only met actually on a few occasions. But he sent me this book called Roots of Imagination, and it has a section called Writing Lives. And much of that section is taken up with his correspondence with me. I was looking at the book this morning, and the correspondence makes a little book in and of itself. It's over 100 pages. The to and fro between Chip and me. Consider this really, this podcast, a collector's item. The book itself is a collector's item. It's privately printed. Maybe someday it will see the light of day as a book you can purchase. But for right now, if you want to know about this correspondence, you have to tune into this podcast. And why should you? Well, I know of nothing like this correspondence. There may be other exchanges of letters like this, but between a biographer and someone who is not a biographer, who is a writer of tremendous power, who takes an interest in biography in a way that most writers who do not write biography do not take an interest. And the reasons why they don't, and biography is not really in the canon, so to speak, I think is revealed in this correspondence, which ranges through all kinds of issues about biography in the back and forth. And I'm going to back up, so this will be a kind of review for people who've listened to the first podcast. I read excerpts from the first couple of letters. But what I'm going to do now is read the letters in full. In some cases, Delaney has footnotes explaining certain things about the correspondence for someone who he sends this book to, who will not know the context of how our correspondence was created. So I'm going back to December 16th, 1996, addressed to me, Carl Rollison. I was living then in Brooklyn. And he says, "Dear Carl Rollison, it was a pleasure to meet you at the Arts Club yesterday at the party Carol threw for Ted's birthday." And then he has a footnote. I'm going to read his footnote. "Carol Klein and her husband, Ted Klein, lived across the road from our friends, Leonard Gibbs and Sam DiBenedetto, in Canaan, New York. Carol was a biographer who had written a biography of Aline Bernstein and a history of Gramercy Park and American Bloomsbury. She had rented a room in the Gramercy Park Hotel in which to throw a party for her husband, Ted Klein. Many of the people who came that afternoon were biographers and writers. I was invited because I knew them from Canaan. While there, along with Marion Mead and several others, I met Carl Rollison, who, with his wife, had recently," parentheses he puts March 1996, "signed a contract with Norton to write a biography on Susan Sontag. Carol herself eventually died after being struck by a car in New York City's Upper East Side a few years later on July 2nd, 2001. I go back to his letter. He says, "I must say, a bunch of biographers all together in one room can be quite daunting. The general tendency when many of you get together to joke about your subjects probably comes from the same mechanism that causes medical students to indulge in their famous grisly humor and macabre practical jokes. That is, humorous relief from the anxiety generated by having to work and study so close to death. For biographers en masse, probably it's the anxiety from having to live in such proximity with," puts in quotation marks, "the great. A natural tendency is to denigrate, deflate, and generally poke fun at. I should mention, however, that I don't think I've ever heard anyone, he underlines that, italicizes it, who knows her call Susan Sontag Susie, as I did around the table yesterday, that is, he heard us talking about her that way. Anyone I've ever known who had a personal relationship with her, from passing to intimate, calls her Susan, but I'm sure you're aware of that as I am. At any rate, here is a Xerox of the promised article. And he has a footnote. See Under the Volcano with Susan Sontag, Reflex Magazine, 1992. He did an interview with her, which my wife and I were interested in obtaining. At any rate, here is a Xerox of the promised article published a few years back. The basis of the quotes in my piece is a 50-page manuscript of an interview I did on 21 June 1992. Let me know if it's all right with Susan. I'm perfectly willing to share it with you. Hope we'll be in touch. To you and your charming wife, all best wishes of the season. And he signs it Samuel R. Delaney. That's December 16th, 1996. Here's my full reply, which I did not read last week. December 27th, 1996, about 10 days later. Dear Samuel R. Delaney, thank you for sending your interview with Sontag so promptly. Of course, it is more than an interview. We are very much in your debt. Some of the links between her essays and fiction that you mentioned had not occurred to us. I especially like your discussion of the structure of The Volcano Lover. I find the novel as rewarding as you do. I am struck as well by the relationship between The Volcano Lover and On Photography. It seems to me that Sontag's feelings about collecting and about making images of the world are best expressed in those two works. Sontag's book on photography directly inspired my biography of Monroe, which had as a working title, The Replicated Life of Marilyn Monroe. I had just started on the biography when I met Sontag in Poland. This was 1980. Meeting her in person, Lisa met her too, was thrilling. We both had an incredible visceral reaction to her. I was amazed that she let me sit down next to her and talk for a good 15 minutes, and this was at a literary conference where people were vying for her attention. I'd also like to comment on your shrewd letter. I'm sure you're right. Many biographers as a congregation are rather like medical students who are famous for their grisly humor. Forgot to read a footnote of Delaney's, which is kind of funny. Right after I addressed him as Samuel R. Delaney, I spell his name D-E-L-A-N-E-Y. And in his footnote, he says, like many people, Rollison began by misspelling my last name. There's no E in it. It's D-E-L-A-N-Y. Since we discuss it, I'm leaving it uncorrected in the text. Until, he says, circa 1965, every Delaney in the Manhattan phone book was a relative of mine. And then he has a footnote about my biography of Marilyn Monroe. He says, the irony here is that Rollison's biography of Marilyn Monroe was inspired by Sontag's book on photography, while that will be among the works Sontag herself will cite that make the Rollison seem unfit for doing her own biography. That is, she thought anyone who wrote about Marilyn Monroe couldn't possibly write about her. It reminds me, by the way, of a review of my Rebecca West biography in the Wall Street Journal, which was a very positive review of the West biography, but the reviewer was puzzled. How could someone write a biography of Marilyn Monroe and then write a biography of Rebecca West? Now, you see, it seems to me that there's a presupposition there. There's a conception of what biography must be and who a biographer is and what is an appropriate subject and what is not and how one should present oneself as a biographer to the world. I'm also reminded of a biographer who specialized in biographies of British subjects. And after I had published my biography of Rebecca West, she said to me, you know, you should keep doing this kind of work, that is biographies of British subjects, because then you'll know, you'll be known, you'll have a brand. She probably didn't use the word because it wasn't really common coin in the 1990s the way it is now. But essentially she said, you know, if you want market share, so to speak, if you want to brand yourself, you need to be known for a certain kind of subject. And I've done just the opposite. People look at my output as a biographer and they see no rhyme or reason to it. There is rhyme and there is reason to my biographies. But again, most people who have certain preconceptions about what biography is or who's writing the biography automatically defines the biographer. And I've been defined like this. I'm rather like Rebecca West. She once said, you know, there isn't more interest in me because there are all these interstices between my different works and people don't know what to make of them. I think that's probably true in my case as well. Anyway, going back after this long digression to Samuel R. Delaney's footnote, he says, Sontag cited my Monroe book as the reason why I was disqualified from writing her biography. Delaney says in his footnote, on the one hand, I am surprised that they, meaning my wife and I, never conveyed this to Sontag, that is, that we had been inspired to write the Monroe biography by reading her book on photography. On the other, Delaney says, I note that Sontag seems to feel they wrote a biography of Muhammad Ali. As far as I know, it was simply her own invention. Well, it is. We never wrote a biography about Muhammad Ali. But as I found out in looking at her archive at UCLA, she had all kinds of conceptions about the motivations for our biography that were just absolutely nuts. One of them was that I was some kind of right-wing fanatic because I wrote for the New Criterion. I'm not a right-wing fanatic. I'm not a right-winger. I wouldn't even call myself a conservative. But have I been published in conservative publications? You bet. Lots of them. I'm writing for one right now, the New York Sun. Well, so I was in the midst of explaining before Delaney broke in with this footnote in my letter about our, what I call, thrilling meeting with Susan Sontag. We both had an incredible, visceral reaction to her. I was amazed that she let me sit down next to her and talk for a good 15 minutes. And this was at a literary conference where many people were vying for her attention. I go on and say, I'd also like to comment on your shrewd letter. I'm sure you're right. Biographers as a congregation are rather like medical students who are famous for their grisly humor. We no doubt have, as you say, anxiety from, quote, having to live in such proximity with the great. I'm reminded of what Mark Stevens said about biographers, less interesting writers writing about more interesting writers. Stevens and his wife are writing a biography of Willem de Kooning. So yes, I suppose we indulge in things that make our subjects seem less daunting. But there is another aspect to our calling Susan Sontag Susie. We have interviewed close to 40 people now. We have spoken with her friends, former students, writers, casual acquaintances, and none of them has called her Susie. We call her Sontag and sometimes Susie in a parody of familiarity with our subject. We never refer to her as Susan because we are not her friends, and we do not want to be her friends, not so long as we are writing her biography anyway. I think there is a real danger in getting too close to a subject. Too many biographers, for my taste, try to become insiders and to placate their subjects or their subjects' estates. The subjects of biographies, if they live to see what someone has made of their lives, are almost always dissatisfied. There is such a difference between a life and a biography, also between a life and an autobiography. A biography is a book, to state the obvious, and one biography must be answered by another because there are no definitive biographies, no books that can ultimately do justice to a life. I happen to hear you asking Marion Mead whether it wasn't true that the subject of a biography ought to be able to recognize himself or herself in the biographer's book. I didn't hear her answer. I remember your expressing to me your dismay over a writer who had gotten certain basic facts about you dead wrong. It's true. Biographers make big mistakes, although I don't think you were dealing directly with your biographer. After seeing us in action at the party, you may dread the day a biographiend, as Joyce put it, pursues you. Even with mistakes, the biographer may be getting at a truth otherwise unavailable. In my own experience, friends of my subjects, and sometimes their family members, have said to me that my books told them things about Monroe, Norman Mailer, Rebecca West, to cite three examples, that were revelations. There is all the difference in the world between the person you think you know really well as a friend or family member and what that person looks like to a biographer, who can have a certain insight precisely because he or she is not part of the subject's intimate circle. It is a matter of perspective and pattern. This sounds like bragging, but my intention is otherwise. When I turn Susan Sontag into my subject, I see facets of her that people really close to her cannot see or cannot permit themselves to see because they are so close. They don't see the implications of certain behaviors because they have become part of those behaviors and have even reinforced them. And I'm going to digress for a moment. I was writing this in 1996. More than a decade later, when I was working on a revised version of the Sontag biography, I had access to her archive at UCLA. And one of the things I found out, she kept a file on me, was precisely that she had all these friends that were reinforcing certain prejudices and biases against us, people who had met us and who had formed certain conclusions about what we were up to. And what they would say to Sontag pretty much, you know, supported, reinforced what she wanted to think about us anyway. I go on in the letter. I have often jokingly referred to myself as an outlaw biographer. I mean it in the sense that I am on the margins and have to work as close to the center of things as I can get. It is lonely and I feel exposed. It is an enormous advantage for me to have Lisa on board, as she has edited all my books and given me invaluable advice. What I'm leading up to is that I would never ask Susan Sontag if it was okay for you to show me the transcript of your interview with her. I don't ever want to be in the position of asking for such permission, of having my subject or subject's estate doling out information, giving me their blessing, and so on. I pay a great price for being on the outside, and I'm sure I miss some things that intimates of hers know. But I think they miss something as well. And what the hell? One day a friend will write a memoir of her, probably taking me and Lisa to task for our errors. I can live with that. Well, there have been some errors. There have been some memoirs of Sontag. They don't deal with us, probably because we're beneath notice as biographers. So I go on in this letter. Oh, and I've covered this in other podcasts as well. What they did do is, when Benjamin Moser wrote his really scurrilous biography, as far as I'm concerned, of Sontag, one of the things people did is they made stories up about us. And Moser put them in his book. Things about us showing up at Ferrer, Straus, and Giroux and badgering Roger Strauss. Absolutely laughable stories. My wife and I have never been in the offices of Ferrer, Straus, and Giroux, Sontag's publishers. We never had a direct conversation with Roger Strauss. I met him once at a party, but we didn't talk about Sontag, that's for sure. We had no significant conversation. And I certainly, if you know anything about Roger Strauss, the idea of even getting into the Ferrer Strauss offices and badgering Roger Strauss is just ridiculous. And Moser put all that in his biography. I happened to get the galleys of the biography, and I had all that stuff removed. Lisa and I wrote a letter, went back and forth with lawyers for Moser's publisher, and they finally yanked the stuff out of the book because it was just ridiculous. Why a biographer? And he never contacted us, you know, never. It wasn't a matter of just we said and those other people said, you know, conflicts about events. he had events in his book that just never happened at all. The disrespect to fellow biographers I found just extraordinary in this fellow. I wouldn't credit him with anything. Well, after that tirade, back to the letter. What I'm leading up to repeat, is that I would never ask Susan Sontag if it was okay for you to show me the transcript of your interview with her. I don't ever want to be in the position of asking for such permission, of having my subject or subject's estate doling out information, giving me their blessing, and so on. I pay a great price for being on the outside, and I'm sure I miss some things that intimates of hers know, but I think they miss something as well. And what the hell? One day a friend will write a memoir of her, probably taking me and Lisa to task for our errors. I can live with that. What I've said probably means I won't ever get to see your transcript. That's true. I never have seen a transcript of Delaney's interview with Sontag. I've seen the published version, but not the transcript. That is a shame, I say, because I like your profound respect for Sontag and I want it to be represented in the book. At this point, we have a letter from Sontag's agent, Andrew Wiley. He has asked us about our book, how long we are taking to write it, whom we would propose to talk to. We've answered him. We may get to interview Sontag, and then again, maybe not. She has chosen to deal with us through her agent, who has left the door open and made no attempt to discourage us. Well, there's lots to be said about Wiley's letter. I can't remember if I said it in the correspondence or not with Delaney. If I haven't, I will at some point clue you in. So I go on. If you don't mind, we would like to ask you a few things about the circumstances of your interview with Sontag. This is me again saying, you know, you get what you can from people. If they're not willing to tell you the full story, maybe there are things that they're willing to tell you. Did you set it up directly, that is the interview, with Sontag? Or did you work through Ferrer Straus? Did she have a chance to review your piece before it was published? Did she ask for such permission? These are important questions to us. Interviews have usually been carefully vetted by her publisher, and the kinds of questions asked have been strictly controlled. If your experience was different, that is worth knowing. Indeed, anything you feel free to tell us about the circumstances of the interview will be deeply appreciated. We could talk on the phone or meet in person or correspond by letter if you prefer. I thought it important to explain how we are doing the biography. We want to be as accurate and as fair as possible, and that is why we extend our interviewees the opportunity to review the remarks if we use them in the book. And I didn't say this in the letter, but it's what I have always intended. Yes, they have the opportunity to review the remarks. They have their opportunity to correct errors, obviously. They don't have control over the interview itself and what I ultimately make of it. I closed the letter by saying, your letter really set me off. I've written extensively about the subject of biography. I've published the first annotated bibliography of writing about biography. That was published by Salem Press in 1992. It's called Biography and Annotated Bibliography, still available in paperback. And I often teach courses on the subject at Baruch, that's Baruch College, City University of New York, from which I am retired. I say in closing to Delaney, you wrote a letter. I wrote an essay. Forgive my obsession. Best regards, Carl Rollison. And then there's a reply on January 12th, 1996. It's a very long reply. In Samuel Delaney's book, it goes from page 216 to 224. That's a lot of printed pages. I'm just going to read you the first paragraph. Just as a kind of teaser for next week's podcast. This is Samuel Delaney. We started our correspondence in December 1996, It's now January 12th, 1996. This is Samuel Delaney writing to me, Dear Carl Rollison. Actually, he misstates this letter. I just noticed this. December 1996 is when we started writing. He then dates this letter. We all do this when we start a new year. We forget when we write the letters that it's a new year. We started writing in December 96. And then he has this letter January 12th, 1996. It's actually 1997 that he's writing this, the beginning of 1997. Dear Carl Rollison, this apology for taking so long to get back to you on your considered and considerate letter of December 27. More than a formal and phatic phatic figure, it is in so many epistles. Yours of the 27th reached me, if I remember right, on January 2. Immediately, I was struck by your seriousness and your thoughtfulness, and I was prepared to leap to the typewriter to respond, both to your specific questions and to the more theoretical considerations. And then he goes on to explain that he became ill after receiving my letter. Worst sore throat I've had in 54 years, he says in his second paragraph. I hope my letter had nothing to do with the onset of this illness. But the fact that he takes so many pages to respond, first of all, I consider a great compliment to me. And one of the reasons why I'm reading this correspondence is, again, it's so, you can't read essays about biography like this. You can't get this kind of almost like platonic dialogue on the subject of biography. I had considered publishing our correspondence as a book many years ago and never got around to it, never got around to asking him how much he valued the correspondence and could I get his permission. And then, you know, a few months ago, he writes to me and says, I'm thinking of publishing the correspondence. He didn't say, how do you feel about it? But he was essentially asking me, you know, whether it was okay for him to do this. And I said, yes, I was absolutely flabbergasted and impressed that he had kept this correspondence and thought it was of so much importance. And again, I think it is unusual in biography. I want to say the history of biography, which is, you know, quite a pretentious thing to say. But I am a scholar of biography and the history of biography. And I've never come across, in all the books on biography, I've never come across this kind of dialogue that, say, Oscar Wilde published in his essays about the critic and the role of the critic. This is a very similar kind of correspondence about the role of the biographer and a person reading about the biographer's work and the biographer's explanation of his work. So we will resume this podcast for those of you who have the patience and interest in it. Next week, next Saturday, I'll be picking up the correspondence again. It is, as I said, a long correspondence of over 100 pages. It's going to take some time, but you won't be able to read it anywhere else. This book is not for sale. Maybe someday it will be for sale, although there are a lot of rights involved here. I've already signed away my rights. I'm not expecting any recompense, anything for his permission to use my correspondence in his book. So I hope that's a good reason for you to listen to this podcast, which I am calling a collector's item. Thanks for listening.